Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to Deep Thoughts on this gorgeous sunny day. Must be like 74 to 76. Breezy, just a tiny bit of breeze. It's going to be a really good, gentle environment to talk about the third episode in a series of episodes on screenwriting. And this one's going to be about character development. I own a ton of books on this stuff, just so you know. Probably, without exaggeration, between how to make a film, mechanically speaking, to how to write a film or write for television, I don't know, 25 books, all of them largely digested, if not once, two or three times. My personal training stems from Robert McKee, McKee. I'm giving you this little pedigree here so that you can know what you're about to get into. I have a writing mentor. That's all I ever call him because I'm not sure he wants to be a part of this show by name. He's a very brilliant, talented man. He sold over 20 scripts. He absolutely gives it to me straight. He will brutally destroy one of my scripts 5-1 over any compliment. And so when I gain compliments from him, I know I've done something. So I am going to come at you from a perspective of the following. The reason why I really want to do this episode is that, as I've said in my other two episodes, the art of writing screenplays, which is like saying the art of making film, right, is a super coveted, meaning protected thing. That those who end up getting in typically keep everyone else out so it can be their little special thing. And believe me, I understand why they do it. Because it is very tough to get in at any level. Being on set and carrying lights, not so difficult. But getting involved with the actual creative elements at the top, very difficult. Once you're in, the rumor goes is that you it's hard to get out once you're in.
Right.
Now, this particular episode is about developing your characters because I have seen one of two attitudes in all the literature that I have, the books that I have, the seminars that I have gone to, the dimensionality of a character and how to make a character is either assume that you know, which is a ridiculous thing when you're trying to get educated about how to do something, right? It's just for the person to say, well, if you don't do that, if you don't know how to develop a character, then you shouldn't even be in this game. There's a lot of assholes like that in the world, right? Well, if you don't know, you don't know. But maybe you have great stories and great premise to put the stories into, and you're being robbed of the opportunity of telling that story because no one will help you make a character or characters. The second side of what I see when I read about character development is usually someone giving you, you know, they're writing a book about writing screenplays or whatever, and unless the book is dedicated to this, and I've seen some out there that I don't own, so I apologize, but I'm in the middle of a rewrite of an old script of mine, and I'm just on fire, and I love it. And so I thought, man, all these issues that I'm fixing and making better are all related to developing my characters, so why not just stop and make an episode, right? But the other one is someone is trying to write a book, and they really don't want to cover this section. And because they can't frame it in their own mind. They're good at it. Perhaps they're successful at it, but it just comes to them. And the problem with that is you're not a good teacher. And a lot of these publishing companies give book deals to folks that are accomplished with their end result, but they can't teach to save their soul. Right? My partner in the show, the other show, MK Ultra Radio, he's a fantastic guitar player. Don't ever ask Kyle to show anything on a guitar. He can't do it. He's not a teacher. It's like he can't teach you how to drink a glass of water. But he's really good at drinking glasses of water. It's weird. I was asking him the other day how to play an old song, Into the Void. And I said, well, just tell me what, you know, the solo, you know, just get me kind of started with the solo and how you're fingering it and da-da-da. And he's like, I just do this. I was like, dude, pull back. He's not an educator, and that's fine. So I've seen basically lighthearted attempts inside books. And so we're going to go at it from a multi-pronged perspective so that you understand what you need to do. And I've never said this before, but unless you've got a fantastic memory, you may want to listen to, if you're in your car, you might want to listen to this at a later time with a pad and paper. Or if you're watching it at home and you're really interested in this, not just a casual thing. If you just have a casual interest, then just listen and dig it and, you know, go back and watch it again if you actually want to engage in this stuff. Because I think there's going to be some things in here that you're going to want to jot down as, I wouldn't say, it is going to be a checklist, which I hate to say anything in story writing is a checklist, but there really are checklists, right? Now, I debate on how to approach this because I don't want to lose any of you if you're not in one of these different groups. So I'm going to say to you, I've written a film last year, towards the end of the year. It's an extension of an existing franchise because all my buddies are in that franchise. And it dealt with, it was a sequel to a movie. And so I just want to give you this from a point of view of how you would develop your characters just from the onset, right? When I started this film that was a sequel, I had characters that already exist, some that have existed for a long time in the franchise. Some of them are recent additions from the last movie that have to be carried forward. And so I've got that, those two things, you know, on my back. I've got characters and I have to know them like the back of my hand, and dozens of writers have written those other characters. And so I have to get in the brains of what they were thinking. You know, it's as if you were hired on to Game of Thrones and someone says, well, we need you to write this episode. Well, Game of Thrones is like, what, 5 seasons long? Extremely long episodes, extremely long series. You better know what a person would say and what a person has said such that you don't repeat a cliche too much, right? I know I'm going into details, but I just want to give you a slight little view into that, this other chamber of writing a sequel, which we're going to go to last. But that's why I want to mention it first. Obviously, you're going to introduce your new characters as well that have to co-mingle with those characters. You're going to need to look at society and find out what will be interesting to say in the first place. But again, we'll get into this because it's starting to cross over to the other one. Now, the other one that's more fun is you get to write your own movie completely from scratch. Make your own character names, their actions, what they do for a living, how they interact, what their idiosyncrasies are, and that kind of stuff, right? Then you might be in the middle. The part of the film I'm rewriting is that one I wrote for Chris Hemsworth initially, and it's a historical piece. And I had to do just a mountain of research on this whole era of the world, where it is, and that kind of stuff to write this script in the first place. And now I'm revisiting it, having improved my skills dramatically since I wrote this particular film. And I'm going in and fixing things. I'm even re-looking up history and finding out some of the names are different. Thank you, Mandela Effect. And so I have characters that must be in my story, sort of like inheriting a sequel. But I get to take them where I think that they should go based on the argumentative history of these characters over time, right? But let's start fresh. Let's start super duper fresh. When you have an idea, as mentioned in episode 7, which says it's episode 8 when you run it. When you have an idea, like a premise, and you are feeling some really cool story flow, right? You've watched all your Twilight Zones, you got them all memorized, you've seen all your Star Treks and all your big series, and you got a bunch of arcs in your brain memorized about boy met girl, girl met boy. Then you realize, okay, I've got something that's sort of interesting, a twist, a mechanic. I don't have a story yet, right? So now I got to find a reason why anyone would care about my premise, you know? You know, again, it could be time travel. It could be a guy who comes to America in the 1800s. And you just think, wow, what would it be like to be a guy coming to America, penniless, no family? In fact, his whole family got killed, and now he ends up being the guy that runs the city, and he's the most powerful guy on planet Earth in this region of the world, and let's just tell that story. Make it all up, right? Not a very exciting premise there. What'll happen is this. You get super duper excited to write. You'll obviously have probably the first 30 pages in your brain. And you'll start writing like a bat out of hell, right? And I'm going to preface this with, I talk about a four-act play. So my screenplays are in four acts. So when I start talking about third act, and a lot of you know what third acts are, typically I'm not talking about the end of the film yet. Fourth act for me is the end of the film. So just get that little nomenclature thing fixed up. But what'll end up happening if you rush into a script, even if you're brilliant enough to write the first act and the fourth act, and you think, oh man, all I gotta do is write two and three in the middle, 30 minutes a pop, and we will button this thing up and sell it to Hollywood. Here's the thing. I'm gonna give you the magic trick to figure out whether or not you've done your job right when developing characters. There are two types of problems you run into when you're writing, typically, in terms of categories. One of them is terrifying, and one of them is exciting. The terrifying one is you get bored of your own movie. And that's where this is going to be your savior. This show will fix you and your boredom with your script. The second type of problem you have is the complete opposite, which is you're utterly excited, but you're frustrated because you run into a mechanical problem with your story. And what does that mean? Well, you need something to occur. You know the A and the B, the two points that this script needs to travel. And the action that you have created, the dialogue that you've created, and the interaction that you've created between characters and their environments is utterly not working. It's just, you know, it could be, I ran into an anomaly with the script I'm writing right now where I had a person carrying a weapon, and the weapon was actually very large, and it's sort of gaudy. And he's carrying it around, and I just sort of didn't pay attention to the fact that if he was actually carrying this weapon, he would be stick out like a sore thumb. It's almost like carrying a road sign on your back, right? And so I had to dial back. I had to reimagine the weapon itself to make it slightly smaller. And then I had to have a situation where he gets rid of it at a certain point, and then there's a reason why he gets it back, and everything has to be, you know, balanced. I made the weapon more sexy, so then when it's first debuted, it's more intriguing, more mysterious. I have him having it confiscated from him, which is a tumultuous thing for his soul. It's a cathartic moment that brings out the character's dimensions of, hey, this is mine, but they managed to convince him to turn it over, temporarily speaking. And then when the weapon gets back in his hands, it's a joyous reunion of this weapon. And he ends up demonstrating its capabilities in a very, very intense way. But mechanical problems are where you grab your dictaphone. And I'm just going to recommend, again, that you guys get yourself an Olympus dictaphone. You can use your phones, but honestly, you drop your phones, you lose your phones, and the last thing you want is a device you're carrying around the entire world to have all of your secrets in it. Whereas a dictaphone usually sits more close to your person, sits at home a lot. But these things, I have a little Olympus. Just look up an Olympus dictaphone. I spent $100 on mine. Again, it has like 60,000 hours on this thing, and two AA or AAA batteries. The thing just goes forever, and it's legal to hold in your car in California and talk to. So, you know, I recommend using these things. But when you have the mechanical problem, you essentially should get up, pace, and talk to your dictaphone until you work it out. And you just keep talking it out loud like you're role-playing it from some, you know, Dungeons and Dragons thing. You must be able to do that. That's just my recommendation. But now a mechanical one would be hard for me to help you resolve other than what I just said. I mean, I could probably go another 5 minutes on it. But that's not the real problem that you run into when you're panicking. And I'm just going to go through some psychology just to make sure we're on the same page. Because writers, we live a very isolated lifestyle when it comes to writing a script, right? You can't hand off your daily pages to anyone unless you're crazy, because you will not have the next page for them guaranteed the next day to match your quality, like I said in a previous episode. So when you write, you know, unless you're famous or something, which means you would never be watching this, but if you're famous, you know you can just bang these things out, and you also have people to help you write dialogue and action and tune up your script, right? And if you're by yourself trying to get discovered and you're den or whatever, and or your little one-bedroom apartment or studio apartment, and you're somewhere in the world, like you could hear me in Russia, right? I mean, you could, if you speak English, right? But if you're yet to be discovered, which is where I would assume most of the viewers would come for this, you think to yourself, will I ever make it? And am I wasting my life trying to do this? I'm going to tell you that if writing is your passion, you'll know it, and you can't stop doing it. I have had one script, the one I'm rewriting right now, commissioned. And, you know, dude, make this script. We're going to pitch it around Hollywood. The rest of the scripts that I've written have been my elective thing. And the people who, you know, eventually bump into it, dig the work and that kind of stuff. So you can also write and never get on, never actually sell your script, but then you get on other writing projects and you contribute all kinds of cool stuff. It'll just round out the dimensionality of your human spirit, let me tell you. But when you're by yourself and you're going through a moment of what you believe to be writer's block, I would say most of the time it's not writer's block. It has to do with the quality of your characters and how you develop them. Now, I'm going to repeat a little bit from my previous episodes just so we can get on the same page, and especially if since a lot of you will just have hit this first, right? Here's what I have found to be true in my own writing. If I get to a point where I run into what I believe to be writer's block, which I think is the wrong term for it, right? Writer's block almost sounds like you just caught cancer, you know, terminal cancer, and it's just run for your life, right? Let's throw that out the door. Let's forget about writer's block, right? And I've heard some of the greatest writers on planet Earth say that they live in writer's block, which is weird. I think they're over-exaggerating. And again, you don't want to start passing around that term when it doesn't really mean what you think it means. If your characters do not have dimension, if they are not connected into the script properly, which I'm going to give you all these tricks of the trade on how to do it, right? Then your characters will run dry. Their fuel will run dry in the car. And you won't have anything. I got all these planes flying over, I'm sorry. When your character doesn't have a proper place in the script, or they don't have a proper dimension defined for them, then they are boring characters. And when you have a boring character, they could be boring visually, they could be boring intellectually, they could be boring in the way that they have been inserted into the script and that they have no relation with the other characters of any significance. A lot of times people create too many characters. They don't plan out their script well before they hit the screenwriting software. And so they have a bunch of extras, right? Let's say you're writing a war movie, you know, and you got a general and some Saving Private Ryan kind of character. And these two guys, you know, are your main two characters playing off of each other. Super expert, mature adult with all the wisdom, and the kid who's got to go through his maturation arc of growing up. Well, you know that they're going to, let's say that they accidentally get stuck together, right? Some weird little folktale about these two guys who are miles apart in rank, but for whatever reason, they paratroop in and whatever, these two unlikely characters get stuck together and they have to get to Paris before the Germans invade to get out of Dodge somehow, right? I'm making this up on the spot. All right. They are going to bump into a tremendous amount of people probably on their journey, if you want to keep this interesting. What will disembody them from their own story is if every one of the characters they meet has no relation to them, has no relation to each other, and it just remains these two characters bouncing through the pinball machines, somehow magnetically tied to each other, right? Sure, they're probably going to separate at one point and then come back and that kind of stuff to make it interesting. But when you look at movies like Saving Private Ryan, you have, you know, a main character that they're trying to deliver. They created a posse around that character so that they would have a bunch of dimensionality in each one of these characters. You could grow into their characters, fall in love with the things that they say, how they think. You can hear a little factoid about someone's upbringing, their sister, their mother, their father. And the more that the movie goes on, you're vested in them. And then when they get killed, you care. Or when they're about to get killed, or maybe killed, there's something at stake. You're in love with these other characters outside of the main character, right? The reason why I mention this is that when you willy-nilly hit the screenwriting software without things thought through, and everyone does it, you'll just go, soldier. Yes, sir. Back to your main characters. Try to make sure that nothing is left to chance. That if you could have one of the characters that are your main characters, your main posse of characters, say that line, you might actually benefit greatly from that, as well as you'll save the casting director some more hassles. And you'll actually, technically speaking, just to go one step further in that one, you would prevent your film from potentially having a really bad actor as an extra below the line, right? And this happens all the time. Star Wars Awakening. There's a couple X-Wing fighter pilots, a female who is so poorly directed. She's under fire. She's under siege. She's going to die any second. And she's just sitting in the back trying to be remotely emotional. It was so horrible. So that one character, that one actress blew the whole sequence for everyone who has a consciousness, who's going, we all saw X-Wing fights in the first three movies from 1977 to 83. No one forgets Biggs screaming at the top of his lungs when his entire X-Wing fighter blows up around him, right? And that's why, even though the graphics of him crashing into the ground are pathetic models from back in the day, amazing for its time, we buy it, because the guy, the big chubby guy in the cockpit, screamed in a way that we utterly were there, But let's pull back. Because I know that thing is, everybody wants the answers right away, and I'm exactly that kind of person too. So what I try to do when I do these episodes is I knife in to some of the substance, and then we pull out and we go back to, a wide-angle lens, let's put it that way. Here's a trick that I do with all the screenplays that I do. Now, I mentioned in the first episode that what I do is a four-act play format, and what I do is I get into a piece of, Microsoft Word, Pages, whatever, and I create four sections of 12 bullets a pop. You can go one bullet per minute, but usually you don't need to do that. It could be 10 to 12, somewhere in there, and I will absolutely engineer the flow of my script. And that essentially goes daytime, nighttime, the whole thing, all the way down. Who's where? Who does who? Who interacts with each other? And that sort of is done simultaneously with another chart that I'm doing on a different page. And typically when I have an idea, I'm sure you've experienced this too, you really are thinking in those bullets. You're thinking first act, da-da-da-da, and it ends this way. I would always suggest knowing how your film ends right when you start, because that will allow you to tie up the ends with the beginnings, and you can have some really cool twists and turns and payoffs, as they say, right? If you start a little subplot, you got to pay off that subplot. Otherwise, everyone's walking out of the movie theater saying you suck. So the other chart is this. Most of you writing stories, and this works for novels too. The only thing with novels is you have no limit to the amount of bullets you do. But we're going to do screen formats because it's the visual way of telling the story, which is, I think, the most disciplined method. Television is the second one up in terms of ease, because you get a lot more time to craft your characters. But anyway, on the other piece of paper, what I do is I create two circles. In one, I write my protagonist's name, the good guy. And then the other one, I write my antagonist, the bad guy. Now, it isn't always a one-to-one correlation. For the sake of clarity, I'm just going to keep this in your brain as there's a main good guy and a main bad guy. Could be a bad girl too, right? Now, in most cases, your typical script, this isn't always the case, but your bad guys have a posse of people that are involved with the bad guy's agenda. You also have a posse around your good guy. They have friends. They have family. They have coworkers. They have a posse around them. Mother, father, brother, sister. Now, with things like Marvel movies where you have a bunch of superheroes together, those are more towards level 10 because you're talking about lots of bad guys, lots of good guys. You need to really master the singleton instance of this where you just got one-on-one before you get to these giant Civil War movies, right? So if you take an 8x10 piece of paper and you put it in front of you in a portrait style, you want to put your antagonist sort of up in the upper half of the piece of paper and your protagonist down at the bottom, or however you want to do this. I like to put the good guy closer to my heart, but down in the lower half, right? And you can draw a line directly between those two circles because you know they're attached. Now, you have nice real estate on both sides of the piece of paper to put all the other characters you think you're going to need in this film. Now, let's just say we're going to go with the standard family unit fighting some evil villain who's more business oriented. So on one side of the paper, we're going to have some family members and friends. On the other side, we're going to have lynchmen, you know, and henchmen and minions, right? So on the good side, we're going to have a mother, father, best friend. You're going to need to put their names in circles on this good side of the piece of paper. You're going to want to draw lines between them and the main character. And there's two labels you have to put on the line. I always pick just one side of the line for the one piece of information and the side line for the other piece of information. One is the physical relationship between the two characters, brother, sister, friend. On the other side of the line, I put how that character supports my main character, how they enable my main character, right? Now, you might have a situation where if it's a mother, you can assume typical mother responsibilities, but you could just simply write love. And you can also write arrows between at the ends of these lines, which would be if your main character is supporting their mother as a huge thrust in the script, and the mother's not really giving back to the main character, you can write an arrow head simply from the main character to his mother. But now, if it's the other way, where the guy is really being more supported by the mom, you can write the arrow towards the main character. Or, obviously, if it's mutual, you write arrows both ways. But when it's mutual, I don't write anything because there's no distinction there. They're just connected, right? Obviously, the command structure of our bad guy, who's, if he's a general of like Dr. Evil kind of character, he's going to have sort of a number one report. And then you're going to have your minions. You're essentially your mafia class structure at the top. And you're going to think up some goofy names. You're going to have probably an intellectual person that helps the Dr. Evil character. You're going to have probably a muscle-bound character, which doesn't have a tremendous amount of intelligence, who may be driven by this next character. So you're 2 degrees away from the main guy, right? Because the big Jaws-type character works for the henchman's number one. Now, I know what you're thinking. That seemed pretty obvious, right? Why am I watching this thing? Why am I listening to this? He's talking about some basic things we all know. This is where it goes to the next level. Now, once you have the associations between all characters and either the antagonist or the protagonist, the bad guy or the good guy, your next beef that you put into this diagram will utterly make this thing mega interesting. You have to draw a line in your mind. Take two characters that aren't connected from the bad side to the good side, from the good side to the good side, to the bad side to the bad side. And in your brain, you need to say, what if these two folks knew each other for some reason? What if the bad guy kidnaps the mother to put pressure on the good guy? And so you draw a line all of a sudden from the antagonist straight to the guy's mother. And you say, you know, on one side, there's no relationship, remember? On the other side, you say, kidnaps to pressure good guy into capitulating and doing what he's supposed to do in the story. What if the big muscle-bound guy who works for the bad guys, number one, just happens to be a best friend of the protagonist. And at the beginning of the story, this guy was able to conceal his life working for an evil person. And in the end, they get connected because the circuit between the bad guy and the good guy got connected through a story twist at the beginning of the movie. For a lot of you who've watched Breaking Bad, now, this will not ruin anything for you, but the main guy who grows the meth, the main guy that actually makes all the methamphetamine, his wife's brother is the chief of police. And eventually, when the meth gets so insane and so distributed, and it's blue, it's got the special hue to it, he has to go to a family function, and his brother-in-law starts talking about him in the third person because the brother-in-law doesn't know it's him. You see how that connects? So it'd be our main character is this Heisenberg guy, right? That's his code name. And he's got his brother, he's got his wife, his wife's brother. There's a link between the two, brother-in-law. All right. Well, now, at a particular point in the script, the bad guy is always the nemesis of our good guy, which is a bad guy. It was always changed. It could be the Mexican mafia. It could be anything. But towards the end of the series, the brother-in-law becomes the gigantic problem. You see how interesting this gets? So, here's what you got to do. There's going to be a point where you prep your script for a really long time using these techniques. You will have role-played this stuff out. You can take your 48-bullet, four-act format, like I said, 12 per pop, per act. So you got four sets of those, and you can sub-bullet those out. I usually make one that's like, I don't know, between 4 and 10 pages long before I start writing, because the more prep you do, the writing inside the screenwriting software is a breeze. You never run into coarse mechanical problems, because you know what scene comes next. What you'll get into are fine-tuning issues, and those are fun. Again, if you have to go pace, talk into your dictaphone or whatever to flush out a scene, it is so exciting, because it's sort of the feeling when you got out of your parents' home and you started making decisions about your life and what you could do with your life. When you own a story and it's yours, regardless of whether or not it's a sequel, a documentary, or whatever, or I shouldn't say documentary, but a historical piece, you're still in charge of how this thing happens. And that's just fun and exhilarating, and it will not feel remotely like writer's block, right? But the next dimension, the reason why I mention that is because I want you to consider continuing to prep for a really long time before you get into your screenwriting software. The screenwriting software phase should last, I would say, no more than 4 weeks on a first draft. Probably more like 2 weeks, but you might have done 2 years of prep. I know that might be disheartening, but the shorter your piece, the faster it goes, right? So if you're in film school and you just need a 30-minute piece or even a 15-minute piece, everything I'm saying is going to be proportionately quicker, right? But now we have to get into, because now we've talked about the premise of why all these people are connected, the mechanical relationships as to why everything's connected. And technically speaking, there might be layers to this diagram where in Act 1, these are the relationships, and then you could create another piece of paper and say in Act 2, it changes, it morphs. Someone could get married to someone, and then there's a line that exists that's more towards the second part of the film. So you may need to make multiple layers of this diagram. I seldom get to that level of detail because my characters, I guess, haven't really done massive alignment changes yet. But I'm actually got a comedy I've got half written that's probably going to have that problem. But now we have to get into dimensionality. When I first started getting close to Hollywood and listening to actors talk, especially on the making ofs, those are fantastic. Just getting all the DVDs, making ofs, or if you purchase it online, make sure you get the special features. You'll hear about actors struggling with trying to find the dimension of the character. So what is dimension? There's a big joke in Hollywood that the people that criticize characters for not having dimension, the second that they're asked to define what they believe to be dimension, they can't define it. And so they're kind of poo-pooed. It's interesting, right? They're marginalized for their comment. The reality is that they're feeling it. They're feeling the flaw in the character, and even though they may not have a film background or a writing background, they can't quite put their finger on it, they're feeling that the character doesn't have what the character needs. So dimensionality, for me, comes in all sizes, all dimensions of the phrase. How many times have you met someone and there's something really good about them, but then there's something really weird about them, or something really bad about them, but they still have all these other things that are good about them? Dimensions in science is simply a perspective of looking at reality. First dimension, X. Second dimension, Y. Third dimension, depth. Fourth dimension, time. Four different measurements, four different metrics of how to look at reality. Okay, well, let's take that and put it on a human being. You have someone's physical appearance as a dimension. And as I've always said on the show, the way that you dress is essentially telling the world how you think inside, right? You're a product of all of your thoughts. When someone looks fantastic, all right, but they open their mouth and they start talking Ebonics or ghetto talk. They're using double negatives. Now, it could be that they are doing it for fun, to stylize the way that they talk just for the hell of it, but they can talk perfectly normal if they want to. And sometimes that is the absolute apex of their ability to speak. And they can always change and always upgrade, just like My Fair Lady taught us, right? But this is where we start to subdivide your characters to figure out who they are. Now, the traditional writing classes get you involved with some pretty laborious ideas, and it's like it works on paper, but you usually don't want to do it. And if someone says, well, you know, if you want to be in movies, you have to go to 4 years of film school, blah, 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 blah. And you talk to James Cameron, he says, bullshit. You go down to a movie studio and you throw your resume in to hold a light, a C-clamp, right? And you just start paying attention. Read books if you can. Talk to people. Go to school if you can. But it's not a, if you don't do this, you don't get that. Steve Jobs never had a college degree until he was 40-something, in his 40s, right? Bill Gates never had a college degree, right? These people aren't stupid, and neither are you. But someone else telling you that you have an accolade on a piece of paper so that you can do what you want to do with your life, be careful. You know, if you need certification, you got to do it. If you need scientific knowledge, you got to do it. But screenwriting, making films, amen. Just be empathetic and plug into the world, and you're on your way, right? And you obviously need to know how to command the English language. But there's nothing like practicing, and that's how you get this thing going. The reason why I mention that is that one of the classic exercises they'll tell you is to write the backstory of all of your characters so that when you look at your character, you have the complete backstory of who they are. Okay, I'm going to say that that's really smart for two of your characters. Anyone who is a protagonist, anyone who's playing an antagonist in terms of a centralized character that's going to really be on camera a lot, yeah, you should know everything about that character. Where they're born, whether or not they were touched as a little boy, you know, whether or not they had the greatest lifestyle, whether they grew up in the 70s or grew up in the 90s. Two totally different human beings, right? What were they growing up in, a war-ridden world from the Middle Ages or a terrorist-ridden world of this time? Or did they grow up in the 1950s driving convertible cars, playing pinball, and eating chocolate malts, right? You need to know the instinctual spectrum of your character's response. You know, I used all those words in the wrong format. The wrong order. You need to know your character's ability to naturally respond to things, their spectrum of emotion. How mad can they get? How happy can they get? That kind of thing, right? I know you feel me, but I want to give you just a little bit of that. For all the ancillary characters, the side characters, well, you would need to know, based on your diagram of how they're all related together on a story level, not just their functional relationship, you know. There's mothers out there that are mothers in the real world, and there's mothers out there that are your biological surrogates, but they don't have anything to do with your life, right? You're still going to write mother on the diagram, or biological mother if you want to split hairs. It is how the person interacts with their main character and other characters that matters. And if you're going to write a little bit of a backstory or a tiny paragraph or a couple sentences, it would be only necessary to write the sentences that relates to how they relate together. Now, what'll happen is, okay, if you are writing that first sentence, maybe you write 2 to 3 sentences about the ancillary characters and how they relate to each other. You know, it'd be mom to son. Son's the protagonist, right? And so you write, you know, has 3 jobs, has barely seen her son the whole time, loves him to death, has given up everything for him, and he knows it. But he struggles with ever repaying his mom, or because they weren't close physically, they never bonded emotionally, blah, 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 blah. What'll happen is, if you feel and start living a sub-story, when you start writing these couple sentences, which you just set out to write a couple, if your brain, because you're a writer, says, oh, but, and you keep writing more and more sentences about the relationship, then there's your backstory. It was a natural, organic thing, but you didn't go into the exercise burdening yourself with something that you didn't want to do, thus becoming a block to finish writing your script, or preparing to write your script, right? So there's the mechanical, emotional connection between these two people, which you must understand, right? If you say that someone's a BFF, right, a best friend of somebody else, you need to define what that means. You know, I've said it many times on this show, people like to say, oh, that's my best friend, or that's my friend. And I, in life, sometimes I'll go, well, how are they your best friend? And they'll go, what? Well, what makes them your best friend? What have you done for them? And what have they done for you that makes you best friends? Is it just that you're together a lot? But where are your sacrifices between the two of you? What bonds you together? During the apocalypse, do you try to get to each other? Because you're BFFs? Because the BFF would attract another BFF if possible during an apocalypse. No, but no, he's going to take care of his life. I'll take care of my life. All right, well, then you're casual friends. Oh, well, I met him once at a party. Oh, so you don't really know Steven Spielberg. You just posed for a photograph in your phone. Right? You hear this a lot in LA. Oh, I know that guy. Yeah, he's my friend. And I make a mistake sometimes. I'll say it when it's really just an acquaintance, you know? But these are the things you need to know between your characters and your diagram. Now, that's functional. It's an emotional spectrum that we define on paper, but it's still a functional relationship between the two. It's not interesting yet, really. I mean, I gave you an interesting kind of sub-premise, which is your best friend, the best friend of your main character is actually working for the mobster who ends up becoming the antagonist for your main character. So there's a little twist of conflict of interest there, right? So that's a mechanical premise thing that's interesting. But now, let me throw this at you. One of the biggest problems in Hollywood with scripts is, and they're getting hip to this because they actually have people that specialize in this and get Oscars and Emmys specifically for doing this, which is dialogue rewriting. It used to be you could lose your script opportunity with the studio because your dialogue sucks so bad that they simply thought, well, this guy's not a very good writer. This girl's not a very good writer because we just read the dialogue. It's so trite. I'm going to stop reading the script because the dialogue's so painful to listen to. It's so on point, which go see my first episode 7 to figure that out. And the rewrite episode, which I think is 41. When people open their mouths and talk, you know in real life that their entire life history is evident by how they speak, even if you don't know it. I've had a lot of listeners of the show contact me privately and say, I feel like I know you because I've seen, you know, 50 of your episodes and we simply think alike. And the truth of the matter is, we don't know each other, but we probably would have an amazing conversation once we get our little, you know, get our groove on. So when we talk about dimensionality, now what you do, instead of writing a diagram of all these connections, you keep that as your second piece of paper, right? Your first one is your outline of the entire movie, which you're developing slowly over time. Your third piece of paper, or document, would be every character's name. And you may want to do your main characters last in this exercise. Don't feel like there's any necessity to go after your protagonist. Whichever characters jump off the page at you and are interesting to you, why not go for those first, right? Get yourself some wins, some successes in your life such that, you know, that fuels the ones that may not be so interesting. Because the other thing is if you're writing some attributes about a character, the guy's got a stutter, the guy walks funny, the guy doesn't comb his hair ever, he always wears a red shirt, never wears any pants, right? I've written scripts where guys were naked with spray-on clothing. You need to know that that character needs that attribute, right? You know that if you wrote a movie like The Fish Called Wanda and the character played by Michael Palin, Ken, who's got a stutter, it's a comedy written by John Cleese, you're not going to have another guy in the movie with a stutter. You're going to keep that one Chotsky for that guy and that actor who's going to be cast to be able to pull that off in a comedic way, right? That doesn't have to be comedy. You can't have two characters sharing a really intense, discerning disability or quality. Even if you have a bunch of Marines in Platoon 8, you cannot have a guy that comes in carrying in his arm an M60 machine gun, something that should be on a tripod, which is, you know, what Rambo did. You're going to have one guy or one girl who can pull that off, like the movie Aliens. Dimensionality is a very confusing thing, especially when you read characters, but I'm going to give you the connection here, which I've already alluded to. Think of how someone speaks in your script. Think about being burdened with typing every single article, every single word, sentence, paragraph that they speak. Think about what would fuel their dialogue. What would fuel their perspective on reality, right? Remember in Pulp Fiction, which if you haven't seen every single Tarantino movie and you want to be in film, you're crazy. This guy writes dialogue better than most writers on planet Earth and in the history of planet Earth. It's amazing. There's a lot of TV that does great jobs, like Deadwood, the series on HBO, which is long gone, but you should watch that as well. But Tarantino finds a way of making characters like Samuel L. Jackson and John Travolta sit in a car, two lynchmen, killers, who will do anything. They share all that commonality between them. They're friends. I wouldn't say they're BFFs or anything. But they're having conversations in a car about McDonald's in the UK. And it's fascinating. And it's interesting. But think about it. John Travolta's character, they're just bored to death in a car. And the way that that character fills in the time is to start a conversation. Something inquisitive. Do you know what they call a Big Mac in England? I don't even know if it was Paris or I can't remember what he was talking about. He was called the Grand Royale, right, or something like that, or the Royale. A Royale with cheese. And then Samuel L. Jackson's character is not just sitting there going, oh, that's interesting. His character's got grit. His character's like, why? Why do they call it that? You know, he's like, why do they got to change it? Da 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 da. Why can't they just leave it alone? Well, he's got a conviction. He has a loyalty to the brands that come out of McDonald's. And he's like, why would they have to screw with that? What the hell's wrong with these people? You feel the dimensionality of his angle, his perspective on things? Samuel L. Jackson's character is a simple character. So is John Travolta's character. And what they are talking about is something that is not simplistic in the world. It couldn't be just left alone. It had to be localized and modified for the other country. We have to write down things for each one of our characters that will heavily influence their perspective of reality. How does your character see the world? And it must be interesting. If the more that they're on camera, the more that they're actually talking, it has to be interesting. Now, you're going to have a temptation to write extras that are just simply, give me a glass of water, okay, sir. And it's going to happen. But you will find that when you're watching movies, to the degree you have characters that have no dimension, is to the degree you minutely and proportionately fall out of interest in the movie. A lot of times, these movies with a lot of military presence, you do have a lot of exhibition of military process. You know, they show the command structure, and they show you the pride and the loyalty within the command structures, and so there are a lot of guys just going, aye, aye, captain, pa, pa, pa. It's one thing to have an extra say, aye, aye, captain. It's another thing to have Riker from Next Generation in Star Trek say "Aye, aye, Captain" to Picard, because Riker always busts Picard's balls the second he doesn't agree with something. His character has been written to specifically overreact. His perspective is that he's pining to be a captain of his own one day, and he knows that his experience gives him the authority to question the captain's orders sometimes, especially when it really rubs hard. Take a Data character from Star Trek. You've got a character that is a machine. He's an android. So he is very prone to following orders because he's a computer. He thinks in instructions with a CPU. At the same time, when his CPU can't resolve what he's been told to do, he thinks it's dangerous. It goes against some of his own android prime directives of hurting humans. He has to stop and calling things into question. He also has a preponderance to, lament about scientific facts to bore everyone in the room, which is part of his comedic arc, right? How do you make a robot that can't tell a joke funny? You make him more robot to the point where he sticks out like a sore thumb. Now, there are kind of danced around the physicality of someone. The physicality of someone is very interesting because I think a lot of writers forget that it's important to say someone is strong looking. Someone is 6 foot tall. Someone's 5 foot. Someone's petite. But they're, you know, an amazing death machine. You know, they really know martial arts well. A character becomes interesting if they are a paradox within themselves. There's a great series on Netflix called Daredevil. And I certainly hope that you guys in the UK have access to this thing, because it's a slow crawl, but it is, I will tell you that every single episode is masterfully written. The entire first season and second season is masterfully written. The amount of arcs and what we call gaps, where you essentially begin every episode where 2/3 of the episode is typically on average pretty mellow and builds up to the rationale of why the last third of the episode is very confrontational. Now, there are some cliffhangers that carry action into the next scene. Usually it's, we blow out all of your adrenaline and then we get you a nice place to calm down in the next episode, and then we build you back up again and blow out your adrenaline, right? They have a female character that shows up in season 2, and she is extremely powerful fighter. It is not common in this world that females have that quality. You know, we do have females that are soldiers and they're badass, but that's a unique thing, right? Imagine you make a war movie and you got a big giant 6 foot guy, 6 foot four guy carrying that M60. But let's say he's a flamboyant homosexual at the same time. A totally reverse twist on a normal stereotypical perception of a character. Then you might have the petite guy who's an absolute Bruce Lee death machine, you know? So also keep in mind that you're not trying to create the stereotypical cookie cutter of what these characters typically are based on the attributes that you've written down. Try to make them contradict themselves in a very interesting way, you know? There's a little guy in Princess Bride, the movie, and he is the guy, if you've ever seen the movie, is a little guy in there who's just a little bastard. He is the one that's creating the false flag at the beginning of the movie, where he's literally putting the flag on the princess's horse, swatting it on the butt, so it goes back to the king and has the false flag, you know, of who captured his daughter, or his wife, I think it is, right? Princess Buttercup, right? And then eventually he gets into a showdown with our main character, and they play a little game. Well, he ends up talking a lot. Let's just put it this way. And one of the interesting things that they created for this character is a lisp. And I think the real character in real life has a tiny lisp, but he exacerbates the hell out of it in this movie. But he's like this conniving little Napoleon guy who is really smart and ends up has a really funny death. But he gets his own hubris mixed up with his situation and overassumes things and gets himself killed. And it's really funny, right? In the movie Life of Brian by Monty Python, you have a character that plays Caesar, Michael Palin, again, guy who played the Stuttering Ken character. But he has a major speech impediment. And every time he tries to talk to his people, they laugh at his speech impediment, which today would be so politically incorrect, which is so pathetic. But every, you know, his soldiers respect him, but they still start laughing when he talks, and he doesn't know he's got the speech impediment, which is even funnier, right? So in the comedy sense, they wrangle this all together. Now let's get to something serious, like an action thriller film, where you have Sigourney Weaver playing this executive who gets caught up in, you know, being an off-world mining colony. And they discover the alien, which is horrific. She is a person who would never normally have touched a gun. You know, in real life, Sigourney Weaver really was anti-gun. Seems like she's calmed down a little bit now. For those of you who don't remember, Alien 3 wasn't allowed to have any guns because Sigourney Weaver, the actress, was trying to give like a anti-gun statement, and the movie completely and utterly flopped. And Aliens 4 had tons of guns. It was great. Now, I've just willy-nillyed around some very basic things about contradicting elements within a particular character without really giving you the purpose. Go back to your diagram with all your characters connected. Your characters need to be in the script because they have a purpose. They must support another character in a very vital way. Typically, the way that you can do this is to say, your main character, either bad or good, you know, on either side of the fence, has a blind spot in their perspective of reality. And these other characters provide that information in that blind spot to keep them on track or to deceive them. And so you could have a character that would otherwise be positive, and this character is either ignorantly pulling them off track or intentionally pulling them off track. Now, the more you get towards someone pulling your main character away from goodness, you're probably talking about the main line between your protagonist and your antagonist. He's trying to make your main character corrupt. And again, it could be it's happening and they don't know it. That's part of your movie premise, right? So in my emotional designation in that diagram, where I said on one side, it's how they know each other physically, and on the emotional side of it, it is what they provide to each other that is either mutual or one way. And it could be that there is, you know, from right to, you know, from, I should say, yeah, if you have two characters side by side, the right to left arrow, meaning, you know, son makes mother feel not guilty for raising him poorly. The other way, from the mother to the son, is that she makes him feel guilty every day for how she raised him. And so there's this ancestral ecosystem that never gets put out until perhaps the end of the film, where this death cycle going back and forth as a subplot between their emotional states gets extinguished, where someone finally turns to the mother and goes, you know what? You just need to chill the hell out because I'm sick and tired of your guilt tripping. You're my mom. I love you. It doesn't matter that you made mistakes when I was young. We're here now. Let's be present and let's not live in the past. And somehow that, you know, it's very, very lowbrow dialogue. But the idea is to say it gets extinguished, right? Now let's talk about this and jack it up to subplots. In your diagram, and again, these are my methods. Tear the crap out of this. Make it more intense. Put multiple layers on there. And I'm probably ignoring a lot of what I do because I don't want to overcomplicate a text description of something, right? We all know that a film has a controlling idea. The controlling idea is a horrible name for the plot, all right? There is a plot in your script. And everything that you do in that script from start to finish should be serving the main plot. But there are something called subplots. Subplots are invented in two different ways. Subplots are invented to fuel your main story, to give it more dimension, to give it more thrust, to be little booster rockets at times that fire when you get bored of the script. But you can also have subplots which have very little to do with anything. Now, Star Trek Enterprise, I will say, or Next Generation, I should say, has brilliant subplots that fuel the main plot. I'll give you an example. One of the best episodes ever is, I think it's in season 5. It's about the fictional character and nemesis of Sherlock Holmes. It's always played by Data, the android. He, 4 years earlier, had created Moriarty through his buddy Geordi with the glasses and engineering, said, Data, you're solving all these Sherlock Holmes episodes in the holodeck, which isn't any fun because all you've done is read all the books and you just act out the play and it's not fun. You need the computer to create a nemesis for you such that you can't just win. You have to really use deduction as an android to win. And he agrees. And so they tell the computer to create an amazing character. And of course, it reaches right into Moriarty and jacks him up and gives him consciousness. Mysteriously, they don't know how. He knows he's in the simulator all of a sudden. He knows he can leave, but he can't leave. And so they hold him in the computer for 4 years. And the conclusion episode, I believe in season 5, is Moriarty getting out of the holodeck, right? So they have this interesting premise. Moriarty is going to get out of the holodeck. And to everyone's surprise, he walks off the holodeck. And you got Data and Picard looking at him going, this shouldn't be possible. So they join the rest of the crew, and this guy takes over the ship and locks them out and says, you have to bring my girlfriend out as well, safely, and then we're going to book. We're going to cruise the galaxy. And they're like, we don't know how you got out, let alone your girlfriend. What, are you kidding me? And he says, well, you know, you have to figure it out. But now, him just saying you have to figure it out, they could be floating in space for years waiting for them to figure out how to get his girlfriend out. But to add a subplot that feeds the main plot. The main plot is Moriarty wants to get his girlfriend out and leave, right? They start off the episode without any of this Sherlock Holmes holodeck stuff. They start out the episode with the Enterprise in close proximity of two planets. It's like a Jupiter-type planet and sort of a sun colliding with each other. And they're saying, well, in 4 hours or so, these things are going to ignite and become a star. All the gases are going to combine, right? Sort of if Jupiter were to run into the sun, you'd have a big pop. Okay. So there's a timetable that they've got to get the ship away from this reaction, otherwise they're going to die. Okay, well, then they jump into this other story. And Moriarty comes out and says, you got to get my girlfriend out here. And, oh, by the way, I run the ship. They're like, okay, we're going to help you get your girlfriend out. But could you please back the ship away from this colliding sun thing that's going to explode and kill us if we're too close? And Moriarty just goes, well, how about you figure out how to get my girlfriend out? And after you figure out how to get her out, I'll pull your ship back. And he says, you know, it's some beautiful phrase about how, you know, a deadline like this really pulls out the greatness in men. And of course, they immediately start thinking about how to get objects out of the holodeck, and they start trying to solve the problem. But in the end, this tiny little subplot, which has a mechanical function, which is get the ship away from this explosion, becomes the compression mechanism on the main story to make sure you get the damn thing done. And the twist at the end is fantastic. You gotta watch these shows, man. They're great. But definitely watch the first Moriarty. Just cruise through Netflix in Next Generation when you see Data dressed up like Sherlock Holmes. Watch that one first, which I think is season 1 or 2. The other one's in season 5, which you'll see him again dressed up like Sherlock Holmes. Now, the other thing is this. You know when, you know the things get your attention in the world, right? And when you go in public, let's just say, and you see something odd, you come home and you tell your family, oh, there's this really weird guy outside the donut shop, and he was talking to himself or talking to Jesus or something, or this guy was playing the drums down inside the subway today. He was really phenomenal, singing this amazing song. So the guy got your attention. But what if your life went like that all day long, and everywhere you turned a corner, someone's getting your attention? At the end of the day, you would really struggle to tell someone about your day. Be like, well, then there was this, and then there was this, and then there was that. Why am I telling you that little story? I'm telling this story because you don't want to over-engineer your characters to be what we call in stage play, upstaging. For those of you who didn't take any drama or you haven't written before, there's a great term called upstaging, and that means that a character walks on stage, and usually a stage play, and they've taken a tiny, minuscule line that doesn't have anything to... It's not meant by the writer to be noticed. And the character does some physical anomaly to twist it to get attention. And they take attention away from the main storyline, typically is where this term is used, if it's not intentional. But they take away, you know, attention from the main storyline, thus fracturing the audience's ability to focus on what needs to be told. And you usually get in trouble for upstaging. Unless it's a comedy and people kind of bend. My dad was in a comedy when I was a kid. It was called 40 Carats. And he flicked this line and got everybody to laugh. It was really cool to watch him do it. And it became a thing where the director of the play said, that works. It fits. You are one of the main characters anyway, and this is right along the main plot, but that line was never meant to be so funny, and the way you popped it off, everybody loved it. And so it works. So just be careful. When I talk about A Fish Called Wanda and the character Ken, who's got a lisp, or being a stutter, excuse me, he drew massive attention. And so the main villain, played by Kevin Klein, amazing guy, he has the famous phrase, it's Ken coming to kill us, right? And that's one of the lines everyone remembers who sees A Fish Called Wanda. Now, the other thing is this. Then we're going to get into some really technical stuff about working in Hollywood and writing for Hollywood stuff and your character development stuff. It may be that your script is written in such a way that all these characters are fairly quarantined from each other. And so, like A Fish Called Wanda, you have several storylines going at the same time, and then eventually it all kind of Guy Ritchie at the end, right? I mean, coming together. As long as things are quarantined, you could have a character with a fairly interesting physical trait or communication trait or perspective of the world. You know, some could be just be like The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the Marvin character. Marvin is this depressed android, and he's always depressed. And every time he hits the set, he's, life. Don't talk to me about life, you know. So you could pull this off, but once you start bringing them all together, you're going to have to subdue and mute some of these attributes so that everyone's not going crazy, unless you're a genius who can work it all together such that all of these physical attributes that are totally crazy that should not be in the same room together, because otherwise it's going to look like a three-ring circus. If you can make them all complement each other, you're going to have a script that's going to sell faster than you can type it, right? So now, I'm going to tell you some things that might be painfully obvious, and maybe not. And if there's any maybe nots in the next section coming up here, then this is the stuff you need to hear. Imagine you're writing a movie for a very, very famous actor. I had this experience personally, where I handed a script to the main actor to read, and he was reading it on a plane flying overseas to shoot his next film. And he turned to our mutual contact, his best friend, and he said, I don't seem to have a lot of lines in this first act. Now, the reason why he didn't have a lot of lines in the first act is that he was a baby. He's being born. His character is being born, and I have to get the kid to grow up to get to the point where the main actor's in there. And it's probably about maybe page 4 or 5 that the main character starts having all the lines and all the action. He's in almost every single scene between page 5 and page maybe like 114 or something like that, right? But I never thought that a trained thespian would have such a concern so quickly. Because the way that was chronologically told to me, he had finished 4 pages, which read extremely quickly, and he was concerned. And so one of his requests was to say, can you put me somehow in the beginning of this film so my face is on screen right away? And it was no problem. It was no problem to do this switch. And he was right. People who go to see a Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, let's say back in the heyday, would probably not expect to see no Arnold Schwarzenegger in the first shot. You know, when they redid Star Trek with J.J. Abrams, they had a kid who played the young William Shatner, who is actually a friend of mine, the kid, not William Shatner. And he played him as a young kid on a bike, young kid stealing a car. And then we flip up very quickly, probably within 3 pages in that movie, to I forgot the actor's name who plays Shatner now, but he's phenomenal. So be aware that screen time for an actor, if you're going to be pitching it into something and you're like, look, it's got to be Morgan Freeman, it's got to be ba-ba-ba-ba, and this is part of your treatment. I cover how to write treatments in the first episode, 7. You might, one of the pages is to say who you believe would be playing these actors, playing these characters, excuse me. And so just realize that there's a screen time economy that these actors are going to want to have. Their managers are going to want to have that. The studios are going to want to probably have that because, they know this face sold the ticket, right? It's this face that's in the trailer. No matter how you make your film, this is the person that people are coming to see because they have loyalty. You know, there's movies like Star Wars, which are utter one-offs where you have a bunch of unknown actors, which really weren't unknown, but not household names like they were the second after this film released, right? Now, the other one you might run into, which I ran into last year writing the sequel, is that sequels typically have one of two characteristics. They end well or they end badly. And I'm not talking about the audience's opinion of the movie. I'm talking about the writer's opinion of where the story can go from here, right? If someone said to you, someone just wrote Star Wars Awakening, and they actually accounted for the time between 1983 and 2015, right? When you have the luxury of a studio willing to acknowledge that, then you do have a lot of responsibilities. Where has Han Solo been? Where has Princess Leia been? Bah, 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 all the characters down. Where were all these characters? What did they do? And why is it interesting? And how can you make it interesting juicing it back up again? This writer who wrote Star Wars Awakening, the primary writer, was cut short by at least 50% of his normal writing time, which is why that movie feels rushed. When you're a writer, you'll feel the utter expediting of this movie. I'm hoping that the second film, like Empire Strikes Back, is the best of their series, you know. But I just wrote a sequel to a major franchise, and it ended atrociously. The previous film ended atrociously. And it ended so badly that when they tried to rewrite it the first time, they they gave up. 11 guys tried to write the sequel, and it just didn't work. But I had characters that were in physical locations where they shouldn't have been. They didn't really have the dimensionality written into them. Literally, the character was written with limitations that if I were to make them more intelligent, more interesting in the second film, I would be disingenuous to the way the characters were written in the first film. However, the audience already saw this other film. And so they're expecting the actress or actor to be in the new film. And so I found extremely clever ways of reinventing these characters in a way that the actor and actress get to remain in the film. Anyone who's like, well, I'm only going to see the sequel if the person I like from the first film is in the sequel. And so I found a way, and this is one of the big feedbacks I'm getting, is that the way I handled it really worked for people. They like it. Everything always needs a rewrite, right? Now, let's take it up a notch. This is a long episode, but it needs to be. Let's say that unfortunately for you, you're in love with Marvel. And I say this as sort of a tongue-in-cheek thing. You love Marvel. And the first script that you're thinking about writing is a sequel to a Marvel franchise, or you have a set of one of their 300 characters, you have a group that's never had a film written, and you want to write a Marvel movie, or you think you're qualified to write the next Star Wars, or whatever, and you have an epic cast. You have, like the X-Men, you got up to 5 characters minimum on the good side, and another 4 or 5 on the bad side. And you have 120 pages max to write your script in. And I'll warn you that if you go over 90 pages, which I always do, your shit better be tight, because they're going to get bored fast if you can even get the script in front of anyone. Again, treatments are usually the way people like to see things, because in treatments there is no dialogue. And so if they might be judging your dialogue, you're just simply just nailing the story and the premise in 10 pages of double-spaced text. Hopefully trying to write everything one sentence per line. So think about it. If you wanted to write a sequel to Thor, well, you know that there's Chris Hemsworth that's going to play Thor. Someone's going to play a bad guy. And everyone else is sort of just a supporting cast that is subordinate to either one of the protagonists or antagonists, right? Much more manageable. Your first problem, you might assume, which is not really related to character development, is essentially how do you bring a bunch of fight scenes together that haven't already been done before? And why does anybody care? So that's a huge mechanical premise challenge that you have writing a script like that. But now let's say that you are really, really out there on a limb. And you're like, well, I haven't had any films succeed, or maybe you even have, but you're now going to have to write an Avengers. Think about all the personalities that play these characters, the real actors that play these characters, right? You better believe Robert Downey Jr. wants screen time, right? Now, I've never met him. Maybe he loves getting paid $10, $20 million for 10 minutes of dialogue, and he's done. Maybe he likes that format. But I would assume that that guy wants to control the narrative of the film. He wants to be the main character, which is sort of what happened with the Civil War movie they just did, which was great. But you have all these other actors who have agents. These actors are usually pretty sought after in Hollywood for a lot of other projects. And so, you know, the managers walk into the film studios and go, there's not enough pages for my character, for my guy. And you're going to have to balance out the runtime of my actor, my client, versus that other client. It could even be that you mistakenly took, say, I won't mention any names, but a less popular actor who has a hero role, a reoccurring hero role in Marvel, and you accidentally give that guy a little more time on camera than a more popular, more powerful character, even in the public's eye. We all agree that this other guy is more intense than the one that you gave more time to. I'm going to tell you, unless your story is bulletproof, unless your premise is unbelievable, the studio is going to look at your choice of a script and they're going to go, wow, we got to rebalance this whole thing before we show it to our primary staff. Because, you know, when you become a Marvel character, as they understand it, you do get a reoccurring contract with them. So they don't have to renegotiate with you every movie and you come in wanting twice as much money. They don't want to have those problems on their hands. But you'll notice that some of the actors didn't appear in the Civil War episode. There's no Thor and there's no Hulk, right? So you have to be plugged into the franchise that you're telling the story for. You have to be plugged into the fiscal success of previous films within a franchise, especially if you're going to sequel one, right? And some of these are going to be very, very intense, and some of these are going to be much more relaxed. You know, you can write a sequel for a film where no one's really keeping tabs on who's who and what's what, right? If you were to write Saving Private Ryan 2, you know that, you knew the guys in the group and the platoon that was doing, but you're not like saying, well, this guy needs to definitely be the main character and that guy's definitely got to have his thing. And, you know, it's pretty nebulous, right? But in a Marvel franchise, you have requirements. In a Star Wars franchise, you have requirements that you've got to measure when you write the story. You've got to keep it balanced prior to writing anything into your screenplay software, right? The other one is that if you want to make major changes to a script of an existing character set, of an existing casting situation where these actors are locked into these roles, you're going to have to be careful with any giant course changes, right? Where you're trying to make a guy who never cries, cry. A guy who's never weak, weak. You know, Robert Downey Jr., for instance, there's nothing that guy can't do, period. Right? If you can write it on paper and it can be humanly done, that guy's going to nail the role 100%, 100% of the time. I don't know if, like, a Chris Hemsworth character, he had some pretty touching moments in Snow White and the Huntsman. I haven't seen his sequel, but I wouldn't write that guy having an amazing emotional swing because I've never seen him do it in his life to any prolonged length. Maybe he can, maybe he can't. Now, some people might criticize that advice. And they might say, well, you're limiting a great storytelling experience because you're assuming that someone can't do that role. There's truth to that, too. So this is not an absolute, but it's something to keep in the back of your mind as you develop these characters, right? So let's review. Now that we've been over all this minutiae, if you're still here, this is for you. If you are experiencing what is traditionally classified as writer's block, what I'm going to tell you is that you simply are at a page in your script where the characters that are on the page, the ones that have to make this action happen based on your outline, they are so utterly boring to you that you've given up on the story. It's essentially like flying a spaceship to the edge of space where there's no more space-time fabric and your ship can't exist anymore, right? It's that profound. Now, instead of getting depressed, get excited. Okay, here's what you got to do. Go back to page 2. Go back to page 3, right? Page 2 is your diagram of associations and their relationships and how they support each other. Page 3 is their backstory, which makes them interesting. Get everyone on set that's in that scene that's not working. Get those other two diagrams out and make them interesting. It could be that, you know, I'm just going to give you an example. Let's do a comedy solution to the problem. In fact, there's a movie that does this, and I cannot remember for the life of me the name of it. You guys are going to remember. There was a movie where a couple characters are in a museum. And it's sort of a boring museum experience. It's really about a guy, I think, going to see a girl at a party or a museum or something. And he says he's going to bring his sidekick buddy with him. And I think it's played by that amazing actor that is no longer with us, taken way too soon. But his buddy, because the scene's drying up really fast in the movie, because I think the girl wasn't there, it wasn't connecting, and so you're like, yeah, this is a boring scene that should have been cut from the film. But what happens? His buddy sharts himself. You know, he goes for the old fart, and a little more comes out, right? And he's got to admit it to his buddy. And the fact that he's willing to admit it to his buddy is part of the comedy. It's like, you would never tell anybody that, right? Unless you absolutely had to. And so he's got to clean himself up, and he's got to leave. And there's some weird anomaly with the side character sharting himself that made this scene memorable. Now, the movie was so non-memorable that I can't remember the name of the film. But that's that scene I remember, right? Now, in a comedy, you can do that kind of stuff, and you're okay. In a serious film, you have the old phrase, which I've heard a lot of my friends say recently that aren't into writing, and I love the fact this is becoming something that is sort of common phraseology when you watch a movie. There's something called Deus Ex Machina, and I think it means something like machine from the gods or something like that. But anyway, it's an old Greek play mechanism where a Greek play was written to get all the characters completely screwed up by the last act, and a Greek god shows up out of nowhere, typically Zeus, pops out of nowhere and solves the problem, and all the tension releases in the audience. Everyone has an uplifting ending, and they would go home because they didn't know any better. That was not the best way to write. So as you're trying to fix these writer's block issues, it's important to not do a Deus Ex Machina, where you introduce one of the characters on your diagram that's never existed before merely to solve a problem without continuously carrying them through the script, right? People don't like cheats with stories. And even if they don't know how to say Deus Ex Machina, they can feel it and they get angry at you as a writer. Now, the nice thing is the studios are very hip to this and they'll probably stop you from doing this. But I'm trying to get you to write a script to the end. I'm trying to get you over your own writer's block. Then I'm trying to get it to the point where when you take it to the studios, either in treatment form or in full script form, and again, what if you got them to love your, or what if you got them to read your script after reading your treatment, but your script scares them away? There's nothing worse than getting your lips within a millimeter of someone else's lips that you want to kiss, and it never happens, right? It sucks. So let's make sure that you balance everything out as much as you possibly can. Now, let me give you another little mechanism here. It's sort of a cream on the top of this crazy sundae we've built. You have a timeline for your movie, right? You've got a 2-hour timeline typically for your film. You might define your character with a trait that takes a little while to show its face. Someone who is getting ill throughout the film. Now, you can go back to Escape from New York. Snake Plissken is given a virus, which I believe just ends up being the flu or something, right? But he ends up getting a virus. That's might be Escape from L.A., but he gets a virus that's killing him throughout the entire film. So as he gets closer to the end, he's got a timeline to save the president. He's crashed inside this penal city called New York City. And that's the pressure mechanism on the whole film. Now, that's a very on-point mechanism, which was brilliant when John Carpenter put together his first film, Escape from New York. But it could be that as you define your characters, you have something that essentially ticks over with time. It's an incremental issue that becomes more apparent and more apparent as time goes on. Now, obviously, with the maturation script, where someone is learning to do something better and maturing, it could be that they start off completely screwed up. And over the course of the script, the annoying thing starts to go away. You know, there's the movie Finding Nemo, which has now been... sequel is Dolores or something is the name of the fish. I've said several times on this show, I think that the Nemo character, or sorry, Ellen DeGeneres character's little gag of forgetting where she was absolutely worn out in maybe three instances, and they kept it going for 2 hours. And now they're going to make a sequel based on that mechanism, which I believe is... It was funny for a split second. It's an assumption that we have about fish to begin with. I don't think we've ever really proven it. That's a little gag. And hopefully, in this new film, she somehow gets permanent memory. I'm just hoping that's part of the arc in the film, because how could you actually tell an adventurous story where she's constantly forgetting everything? It'd be like Memento, the movie turned into a fish cartoon, right? But, you know, more power to them. I hope they succeed. But you need to be aware of those mechanisms as you go into it. So you could build these things to be locked into place. As I said in my previous rewriting episode, the constitution of a writer actually bringing their art to Hollywood needs to be one of probably at least 40% business, 60% art. Because your stuff will be changed. Your stuff might be completely and utterly rewritten such that when you hear the dialogue of the film and you're at the premiere and your credits rolling in front of everyone's face, and you're like, I wrote this film with additional writers, blah, blah, blah. There's a lot of additional writers that never getting credit, right? You may not see a single word that you wrote. The action might be completely different. And a lot of writers get bent out of shape, piss and moan, and leave the industry or get kicked out of the industry because they're so... They just don't understand this is a business. They've got to sell seats. They have to. I think there's been a lot of miscalculations about what actually sells a ticket, obviously, because, again, in 10 years, the only movie I've been dragged to is Avatar. By anyone. You know, no one said, you've got to see this. Deadpool, I think, was a genius film. Deadpool is a film that's so damn funny if you're in a mature audience age bracket that I think, with nice immature jokes here and there, but it's such a brilliantly made movie that... It's one you would drag people to. It's very unorthodox, right? What I'm trying to say here is, from the rewriting thing, if you can get all this to work together beautifully, and you got to watch the other two episodes to make sure you've got all the juice to make this happen if you're new to this, or new to my way approaching this, is you want to write your film so efficient that scenes have to happen. The dialogue has to be spoken, whether or not it's rewritten by a dialogue expert, which it will be, that you're doing an indie film. They can't afford a dialogue rewrite person. But actors will rewrite stuff right on the spot, too. And sometimes those are much better combinations than the words you wrote, right? But the more that you efficiently bring all the puzzle pieces together and lock them together, the more that you're going to ensure that your art is accepted as is. That's still idealistic. It's idealistic that you're going to have the skill set to pull that off. And it's going to be idealistic that anyone would recognize it enough to preserve it. So there's always someone who doesn't get what you get, and they'll just destroy your script. Again, if you're trying to get into screenwriting or television writing or any type of writing, your credit is what keeps you moving forward, right? And even if someone takes a great script of yours and just destroys it, and you're so embarrassed, there's been a few writers that have taken their names off of things, right? I believe Tarantino wrote, I think it was Natural Born Killers by Oliver Stone that had a Tarantino script, and something happened. I might be wrong, but there's one of them that he pulled his name off of because he didn't like the way it turned out. It happens, right? Thing is, when you go audition for the next position to write, you bring the script that you wrote. So even if they tore it up, you bring in your script and you go, here, I wrote a better script, or here's my version. It's a lot different than the other version. There's a movie called Jacob's Ladder. It's a very bizarre film with Tim Robbins. There's a book that you could buy at the bookstore, which is written by, it was a published book by the writer who wrote the screenplay. He was angry that the movie skipped a very important scene because this movie is about two different worlds. It's about Tim Robbins in Vietnam going through this crazy experience and his life outside of Vietnam when he's back home in New York. And you're seeing these two simultaneous storylines come together with these mysterious characters talking about both hemispheres. And you're utterly confused. But there was a scene where the main character goes off to see a professor at a college and starts talking about paradoxes and stuff. And they really bring it together in a beautiful way. And that scene was cut from the movie. But the guy who published the book said, here's the scene you didn't see that made my movie much better than it was. And it was pretty successful in general. So being in writing is not for the weak of heart. You must have a solid constitution. You must be willing to love your craft. This episode is about you not losing your fuel, about staying on board and finishing your script and realizing the writer's block is complete bullshit. Just go back and redesign your characters. And don't worry if you've got to start a script over. I just started a script almost completely over. I have rewritten. I'm on page 51 of a script that was 113 pages when I found it. It's one of my previous scripts. Out of 51 pages, I have probably rewritten 95% of the lines, if not 98% of the lines. And I'm feeling amazing. And I'm also feeling the drabness of some of my characters. I didn't do this exercise I just gave you when I wrote this film 5 years ago. But I need to personally take care of this baby. This is my baby, right? I've got to make sure that it rests on a shelf perfect. You know, as perfect as I can do at this particular stage of my life. So I'm working really, really hard to make this work out. And I'm going to go off to rewrite my first film. And I'm finishing a comedy. And I'm going to write from scratch a sci-fi film that I got about halfway through. And I died off because I didn't have my outline ready. So I don't have the whole flow of the entire script all worked out. At least the one I wrote is not working. So I'm going to go back into design mode for that other script. So this is something that I do because I love it. It's my passion. You know? And don't worry if someone can articulate their passion more than you. It doesn't mean you don't have it. It's just, you know, you're not wasting your time talking about how you think about this. But once you're in it, you're in it. It's like you live in a little role-playing world every second of your life. Don't feel weird. That's just the way it is, right? I know this is a long episode. I hope this is very, very handy to you guys. These are the kind of episodes I'd love to do a hell of a lot more, but I have to pine. I have to get my own solutions figured out before I can bring them to you guys. So hopefully this was very, very helpful for any of you that are stuck. I'll try to keyword this properly so you guys can find it. I'm going to have to write the title Character Development, I think. It's going to almost not fit on the credits here. If you haven't already, go to mkultraradio.com. It is not about how to write movies. There are three episodes I wrote, or I've done in season one and two now, that are about this subject matter. So just look up screenwriting, and I will put it in the parenthetical description of this episode to make sure it gets in the keyword search. But hopefully this was helpful. If you have any questions, please just put them in the comment section below. If you haven't subscribed, please subscribe. If you haven't liked, please like. If you're listening to this in your car and you'd like to have a video, I don't know why, you can go to YouTube and find it there. If you're on YouTube and in your car, you can get this episode from the website. That's all I got to say. Take care of yourself and someone else, and I will see you in the next Deep Thoughts. Over now.